This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan. The Selangor State Government recently pledged some new initiatives to uplift the ethnic Indian community. On today's show, we'll be taking a look at the issues and uphill battles that ethnic Indians face in Malaysia, particularly in Selangor, how far we have come since the Malaysian Indian Blueprint that was launched in 2017, and how the Selangor government aims to improve upward mobility among Indians. Joining me on the show today to discuss this is YB Charles Santiago. He's the Member of Parliament of Klang. Welcome to the show, YB. Let's start with some overall thoughts and look at the big picture. What are some of the key issues faced by Malaysian Indians, particularly in Selangor?
Thanks for this kind invitation. Well, I think one distinguish problems of people in Selangor or even Indians in Selangor with the other main cities in Selangor, where most of the Indians stay. I think some of the numbers are quite staggering. The numbers that we have at this time, this is, of course, 5 years behind, 2017, shows that only 3% of the Indian B40 own homes. This goes back up to 2007. There has been no recent updates indicating whether the house ownership among the Indian B40 has increased or even decreased. The other issue that seems to be faced by the community is the high levels of school dropout, which is quite serious. And then number two is, of course, gangsterism as well. And a good number of Indian boys and girls, young youths, 40% of Indians between 15 and 24 categorized as unemployed by the Department of Statistics, as opposed to the Chinese, which is about 20.1%, whereas Malays is 29.7%. See how high the levels of unemployment among the Indian youth. As I said earlier, that only 5% of Indian children born to parents with no formal education in attaining tertiary education versus 33% born in Putra and 44% of Chinese children. And this number goes on. It's very sad statistics, but one that reflects the overall composition of the B40, which in my anecdotal perception has increased from B40, maybe B50 or B60 at this time.
This thing about the Malaysian Indian problem and the struggles that the community has gone through over the years, it's something that, it's been talked about for years and years, decades perhaps even, right? But in 2017, the government launched the Malaysian Indian Blueprint, documenting the challenges that are plaguing the Indian community. It seemed like, that was a signal that something serious was going to be done moving forward. How far have we come since the Malaysian Indian Blueprint in 2017?
One must credit the government of the day, 2017, mm-hmm. for having put together a huge document, I must say, a very important document, I must say, which in my view, for the first time, gave a picture, a holistic picture of where the B40 Indian community was. And it was a very pathetic picture that was presented. And there was also a way forward in terms of solutions that were put forward. But unfortunately, the projects were never implemented in the way it was designed. And today, we have a worse-off situation compared to 2017. So, for example, today, unemployment among Indians have increased, say, from 4.8% to 5.2%, for example. Number two, according to a researcher who joined us for the seminar, basically said that poverty reduction among the Indians is the worst. That means other communities have benefited from it. Somehow the Indian communities, Indian community did not benefit from it. And then urban Indians are the lowest wage earners in the country. In 2016, it was the Malays who were the lowest wage earners, urban setting, urban environment. Whereas in 2019, Indians were the worst. I'm using 2019 numbers partly because that is the latest numbers that we have or that I've been can put my hands on. Mm-hmm. Even the government has not done any update on this information in 2019 because of COVID and so on and so forth. I think there's going to be one done this year, but that's 5 years after 2017.
Right.
So basically, you can see with the COVID, with the floods, and now with rise price hike, price increase, inflation, the situation of the poor will be really bad.
Right. Now, let's break down some of the issues that you mentioned, right, in the first two questions. And one of it you mentioned was this idea of gangsterism, right? And it's this is like backed up by a number of studies. For example, a study by the Science and Wellness Organization found that 72% or approximately 28,900 of gang members in Malaysia are Indians. Now, I want to make things very clear that there are 2.1 there are a million Indians in Malaysia, which means that Indian gangsters only make up about 1% of the total Indian population. So the stereotypes that sometimes people bring up, as most stereotypes go, aren't based on anything factual. But I do think there is a serious issue that needs to be addressed here. And that is why a percentage of Malaysian Indian population do turn to low-level crimes and gangsterism. That can be 1%, 2%. But why? Can you break this down for me, YB?
Indians dominate in that particular area compared to the Chinese or the Malays or even the Orang Aslis and others. So that's quite a high number, actually, if you look at it.
Yep.
And it's just not low-level crime, but it's also serious crimes.
Mm-hmm.
That Indians are involved in. Now, this starts from schools itself. If you go and speak to school discipline teachers or headmasters of schools in primary, even secondary school, recruitment takes place at the school level. Recruitment, including to the gangs, and involving also drug pushing of drugs, takes place at the level of the school. And that coincides with the high levels of dropout in the school system as well. You'll be surprised, many years ago, I went for a funeral. It was a 19-year-old boy who died as a result of a gang clash. So as I was going to his house to see the parents and to convey my condolences, it was really sad that while I was going in towards the house, I would have spoken to about, maybe five or six, maybe even seven people as I was approaching the home. And almost all the five or seven, eight people I met were happy that boy died. And I said, why? Why? This is a 19-year-old boy. He should be in school. Why are we so happy that he died? And he said, and the people were telling me, it's just in a low-cost house, a low-cost community. And he was saying, he's a drug pusher. He disturbs our young children when they come back from school. And then when they come back from work, he uses his motorbike. And then he's a bad influence among the children. And he pushes drugs and so on and so forth. Now, this, in some sense, might be an extreme case, but you find many of these extreme cases in poor homes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you think about it, that seems to be the only hope that people have in order to find enough money to support families, to feel that they are important in society, to have an identity, so to speak. And unfortunately, is a big problem. The B40 community or B60 community that we face. And there has been no systematic help in the last so many years to help address some of these issues.
Right.
And I think it's getting worse. It's getting worse.
And YB, could you just elaborate that a little bit? The connection between socio-economic economic conditions of a family, of a community, with crime. Because I think a lot of people, right, when we look at the masses sometimes when it comes to stereotypes and all, they just like to say, okay, those Indian gangsters, as if it's something natural, Indians, they are born and they wish to be gangsters and that's their dream and they want to go and steal and, beat people up and whatnot. Talk to me about how economic conditions can drive people into whether it's gangsterism, crime and whatnot.
As you correctly point out, nobody makes an option to become a gangster. You just grow into it. Locate the neighborhood that you were part of. And also poverty has a way of putting you into crime, into gangsterism, into things that you really do not want to do. You go and speak to gangsters today, the young ones or the older ones, they will tell you that this is not something that we want to do. But we got into it partly because, one, no protection for us. Growing up in a small and in a working class neighborhood, in flats environment, we have protection for us. These were the people that give us protection from people around them. Number two, it was a source of income when they were dabbling in drugs, when they were transporting goods, illicit goods, and so on and so forth. It was a form of revenue, and that helps to support their own lifestyle, including supporting families and so on and so forth. also interesting, you know, why we talk about this as a major income. The average guy involved in crime is not a multimillionaire. Neither is he, well-to-do. It's, again, there as a hand-to-mouth. It is the guys on top of the system, the gangster system, the hierarchy. They benefit a lot, but not the average guy who actually gets shot and goes to jail and so on and so forth. Again, there you have another kind of exploitation. This is where I think the role of government becomes really crucial. Governments have an important role to play. And unfortunately, in Malaysia, the focus of poverty eradication are not the non-Malays. Poverty eradication is highly geared towards the Malay community.
Right.
So I think the real call here is to shift. And look at Chinese, look at Orangasis, look at Indians as part of the larger Malaysian family. And look at all of us as people who need help. And that same support that given or the enabling environment given to the Malays should also be extended to everybody as part of his or her citizenship or citizenship rights, if you want. This is where the problem lies. It begins in schools, it begins in neighborhoods, in poor neighborhoods, and it really gets out of hand. So as I said, you know, I've asked people, you know, how much do you need to come out of this? 5,000-6,000 I need, that's all I need. And this is something that they can earn. This is something they can earn if they go and work, if they have the right skills, if they have skills in school and so on.
Now, you mentioned school dropout earlier. What can you tell us about the literacy rate among Malaysian Indians, especially among the B40 community?
I don't have numbers to give as a comparison on the literacy rate. But one thing I can tell you from people who walk into our office who need help and so on, a good number of them are unable to read or write. They can speak. They can speak to you, but they're unable to put words on paper and so on. And also the older community, those who are about maybe 60 or 55 and above, are not familiar with the Malay language. They can speak mutterings of it, but unable to converse. That is a problem because when they go to government department, they're unable to communicate with the Malay government officers, who are, of course, unable to speak in Tamil. That becomes a problem. So therefore, they have no faith with the government system, and they are unable to go to a government system to access whether it's for justice or whether for services or just to get help or blame and whatever else there might be.
You know, earlier you also brought up this idea of housing and how, that it's a very small percentage, only about 3%, like you said, among the Indian B40 community in Malaysia who own houses. How does that translate then, into another issue, which is also when it comes to, renting and discrimination? Because again, according to a survey, this time published by YouGov in 2019, 46% of Indians interviewed had faced discrimination when renting out, when trying to rent property. So 62% of Malaysians have seen rental advertisements with racial requirements. What is the impact of this towards the Indian community?
Well, I think these are issues of perception. The perception and perception that are very well rooted in society that starts from homes and a highly developed school. Or perception one, that Indians are unable to be trusted. They will not be able to pay their rent. They will keep the house dirty and so on and so forth. Every community has some kind of discriminatory policy or perception against the other community. The Indians have found on the Chinese will have on Malays, the Malays will have some issues with Orang Aslis. You just have it all. But this again tells you about failure of integration. Really of understanding, of your 60 years and above this country, but we have not understood each other. Even neighbors though, haven't spoken to each other. It's something that we can see.
Right.
I think we are also, poverty has got a way of creating perceptions that are wrong. Perceptions that, when you see a young Indian boy, slightly with darker skin, or he must be a gang member. This is quite common.
Absolutely.
It's quite common. The lighter skin you are, the perception is better. The darker skin you are, perception is you're a gang member or you're up to nothing. Those perceptions are there. So I think these are issues that the government has to handle. And these are issues that the leaders of the community also have to manage and to come out, to provide a solution.
How would you respond to people who say, You know, because we are dealing with, when it comes to renting all, you know, private properties here, and that's been, you know, the domination of our housing market in Malaysia. How would you respond to people say, this is my house, this is my private property, I make the rules, who I want to rent it to is my problem?
We are talking about discrimination.
Right.
And I think discrimination should not be supported by any government or any community for that matter. I think just like, you know, there are a good number of crooks in every community, there are also good people in every community as well. So one truth doesn't fit all. So we need to have a different perception of people, of the way we manage people, the way we talk to people, and also the perceptions that we have on people. But this is, again, as I said, we are socialized with it as a child. Malays are like this, Chinese are like this, Indians are like this, Orangas are like this, Ibans are like this. So all of this perception runs in our mind, especially when we are trying to manage issues of rental, jobs, even giving jobs. Today, Chinese and Malay students, Indian students go to Chinese school and they speak fluent Mandarin as well. So why discriminate against people who are not Chinese, for example, or not Malay or not Indian? I think... So these are issues that we have to keep in mind as we go forward as a society. But that, again, it goes back to the heart of the problem that we have in this country, that we have not managed race relations in a very progressive way. We have not dealt with discrimination issues involving all of us in a very progressive way. And that has allowed for festering of old perceptions carry on in the garden level, at primary school level, at university level, And also, as you grow up in the job market and so on and so forth. So I think basically these are issues that we have to deal as a community. And this is where you need leadership from society itself. That means from leaders of society, you know, and as well as from government. You need to have the progressive perception that this is Malaysia. It belongs to all of us. And we have to manage it in a way that we can live in a prosperous, in a harmonious environment.
On the show with me today is YB Charles Santiago. He's a Member of Parliament for Klang. After the break, I ask him about Selangor State Government's plan to address and to push to resolve some of these issues we've been talking about. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashan Johan, and on the show with me today is YB Charles Santiago. He's the Member of Parliament for Klang, and we're talking about the pledges the Selangor government has made to uplift ethnic Indians in the state. So, YB, before we get to some of the solutions that Selangor government has proposed, I want to talk a little bit just about COVID-19, because we've talked about, you've highlighted a lot of issues throughout this conversation so far. But since we're still dealing with the pandemic, the fallout of the pandemic, how has, the COVID-19 situation over the past couple of years exacerbated these issues that you brought up? How has it affected the Malaysian Indian community?
COVID has exacerbated existing inequalities, has exacerbated existing poverty issues. I know for a fact that a lot of Indians, whether they're young, whether they are older, this time a lot of women actually, who are involved in the informal sector, were laid off, which actually means that now they have no social protection.
Right.
Which means that they cannot go and get money from the system insurance provider, workers insurance scheme. They will not be able to get that money. Neither will they be able to access any other support from government. So I, in the last 1-2 years, have been really pushing hard the government to respond to people working in the informal sector. This is a big number, by the way. And a lot of Indian women I see and young youths are involved in the informal sector. Now, pretty much this informal sector works in the following way. You are paid on a daily basis. And there is no social protection. So if you go to work at 9 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock in the morning, you're paid for that day. And that will include maybe a bit of an overtime. But if you don't go to work, there is no remuneration. Also, you don't have any tenure. You're paid on a daily basis, period. You have no social protection. If you lose your arm and leg, That's your responsibility. So this is where I think the government really has to come up and do something about the informal sector. But the point that you're saying is, has it exacerbated? Clearly, it's exacerbated. It actually exacerbated all inequalities, poverty issues across the board, whether it is Orang Asli's, Chinese, Malays, or even Indian. But in the case of Indians, the point of our discussion today, most of them, a good number of them, work in homes. They work in the factories, work in the service sector, and they will suffer a lot. I remember this particular, because we were really reaching out to a lot of people in Klang, providing vegetables almost on a daily basis during the COVID. And I saw a lot of people and talked to a lot of people at that time. And a lot of people were simply just ended because they lost their jobs, their husbands lost their jobs. And there was a single mother who had to raise 4 children without any support because she was an informal worker and she lost. She was saying the only reason she was able to survive is support that came from NGOs, from my office and other good Samaritans in the neighborhood and so on. I'm sure there are many cases of that nature. But the point is, yes, we have got worse off.
We talk about the issues. What is the Selangor government solution to the issue of poverty, lack of upward mobility and discrimination faced by the Malaysian Indian community, especially the B40?
The government actually has done quite a bit in the last so many years, the Selangor government. There has been a very important support for Tamil schools. A lot of Indian poor go to Tamil schools as their preferred choice of education. So as you can see, as a result of the support from the state government and working together with the parent-teacher associations in a variety of schools, the passing rate in Tamil schools have significantly increased compared to, say, 7-10 years ago or maybe even 8 years ago. So you can see a strong correlation between state government working together with PTAs, parent-teacher associations, yep. And LPSs and so on, and also developing and learning from examples of other countries in how they have managed working with challenged children and children under stress and so on, successfully turn things around, but not enough. It is not enough. Right. Because what the state government can do is limited because of its budget and the focus. But this is something that the federal government also must embrace. It is just not giving money for infrastructure development, but also looking at the curriculum, looking at the teachers, looking at students in a very different light. And how do we create an enabling environment that after 6 years of education, primary education, children will be able to read and write and do their math and have a critical thinking process? This is something that has not been done, I think, carefully, because there are lots and lots of children who, after 6 years of education, unable to read, unable to write, and unable to do their maths. So therefore, they are stuck. They'll be stuck, and there's no point for them to carry on for the next 5 years because you know what's going to end, what the outcome will be. So the suggestion by the Selangor government now is to start looking at TVET after 6 years of education. So in that way, you'll be able to arrest the dropout rate among the Indians, among the poor in general, but Indians are one important group, to address the issue of dropout rates and also to provide some kind of a vocational, technical career path. So at least in the next 3 years from, you know, after 6, then they can go to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years of technical education, which actually, one, stop the dropout rate. Number two, provide some kind of a potential for higher income, 5 years. And then after that, they still can go there, do their diplomas, and do their degrees and so on and so forth. Actually, this is the kind of a German model that works successfully in Germany.
Right.
And I think it's something that we can do. So therefore, we need to rethink TVET. We need to rethink TVET and see how to turn it around. Like, for example, the federal government, you have 7 ministries and a budget running billions of ringgit. But nothing has come out. Nothing concrete has come out. So therefore, in our discussions with the Menteri Besar, and he was taken up with the idea, and he said, okay, let's try it in Selangor. Let's see how Selangor-run universities and also colleges actually can start moving in that direction. So that is a proposal that is now being discussed, and I hope something will come out of that.
Absolutely. And there is also like a couple of things that was highlighted in the press release sent out that I'd like to just get some clarification on. And one of it is that the Selangor government will be supporting B40 students at Ladang Midlands Hostel. What exactly does that mean?
Okay. Midlands is a Tamil, there's a Tamil school in Midlands. And as part, and there's also a hostel. Mm-hmm. I think which can accommodate about 200 students. And essentially at this time, it is empty and it's not being used. And it's been there for the empty for the last maybe 2 or 3 years. But it's completely, it is a project of the Selangor government to uplift Tamil schools. But I think over the last 2 years, something fell through the crack and nothing was done in order to get the students there and to put the money that's required. So now the Selangor government has made a commitment. The beginning in January 2023, there will be a focus on at least reaching out to the maximum. The Minister said we will reach the maximum 200, but at least get 100 students from different challenged homes or different B40 homes to come to stay and study at Midlands School. So they will be brought there. There will be, you know, besides going to school, there will be other kinds of project programs, educational efforts in order to enable them before they leave. 6 years of education. But also the Mantri Bitsa said, in fact, he went one step ahead and said that since we already know the problem now, the next 6 months, we can start capacity building projects and programs for B40 children. And that's something that we've done, I think, beginning next month or so.
That's great.
Yeah. So at least there's an opportunity to repress. There's an opportunity to do a U-turn opposed to what is happening right now.
Earlier, you brought up, you know, the capacity of the state government. Paint a picture for us. How much are y'all able to do and how much are your hands are tied when it comes to, you know, improving the lives of communities? In for this purpose of this discussion, we are talking about the Indian community. But how much can y'all do and how much do y'all need approval, or do you all need federal government to really get involved to make this really progress?
I think state governments can play a very important role. Sometimes it is just not about the volume of money, but what you do with the existing money that you have. So in the case of Selangor, after 2008, when Pakatan Harapan won the state government of Selangor, there was an effort to work with parent teacher associations in Tamil schools, in Klang, in elsewhere, and so on and so forth. Now, as a result of that relationship, that means money was being pumped into these schools through the either the school itself, through the PDAs, the LPSs, and working with the non-governmental organizations. There was a very interesting public-public partnership between state government, NGOs, teacher associations, PTAs, and so on and so forth, which actually brought in many programs used by other countries that have worked, especially working in trying to redress and enable poor communities in schools, by the way. So there were programs, I still remember, that was brought from the US. This was used for minority children in the United States, which was used actually in Klang and other places. And as a result of use of that kind of program together with more classes, more structured thing, more programs and so on, the number of passes has significantly increased. Not only significantly increased, in the recent PMR, or not even recent, the last 2-3 years, Tamil school students top the country compared even to Sekolah Kebangsaan and the Chinese schools, top the country. So this tells you that with a concerted effort, with very minimal amount of money, but working together with NGOs, with parents, with teachers, you can shift, you know, the fate of a community. That is what that is required. And this needs leadership. This needs leadership. So you need to have the right leadership and the combination that to move forward. I think Selangor has done it successfully. And I think other states should go. So it's not really, you need billions of dollars. Of course, the more money you have, you know, the better it is. But you still can use whatever little money that you have, well-focused, well-thought-out, well-strategically developed, you can help. But now that idea has to be expanded to other schools in Selangor, especially the rural schools in Selangor, in order for those schools to take advantage as well.
Yep.
And also, you know, the fate of Tamil schools has changed quite a bit. Before, you will see a lot of, majority of the Tamil schools are attended by poor children, families of poor children before 40. But in the urban area, there's a bit of a change where you find people in the middle classes, people who, you know, who drive BMWs and Mercedes-Benz, sending the children to Tamil schools.
Right.
And that too has brought a change in the future of Tamil schools as a school, as a center of education.
YB, in the press release sent by your office, right, there was something interesting that you particularly you highlighted as well, and that basically said that, you know, you have also suggested that the state and federal governments make firm commitments to alleviate poverty amongst the Indians by targeting 10,000 Indians within Selangor and 50,000 throughout the country. 10,000 within Selangor is a good goal, but I guess that where did you get that number 10,000 from, and what does firm commitments mean exactly? What are the necessary measures needed to be taken to really achieve the goal?
Ambitious efforts to reduce poverty, mm-hmm. or to redress the inequality in society started with a new economic policy. And today, that was 1970. Today we are 2022. Poverty has got worse. Inequality has got worse. In fact, even during the COVID period, studies are showing that the rich have got richer, which means the poor would have got poorer. But we have a very divided society, very, very divided society. So whatever efforts that we have put forward in order to eliminate poverty or even to reduce the gap between the rich and the poor has failed. And that means, you know, billions of dollars have gone to the waste. So what is the alternative that you have? So I was thinking about this, just as a way of preparing some notes to deliver during the discussion with the minister. And, you know, I just thought about this. I said, why don't federal governments and the state government identify, say, a good number of families and approach solving this problem from a multidimensional approach as opposed to economic approach alone? Because today, poverty is defined in many ways. It's in a multi-sectoral approach. So you try to deal with health, you deal with education, you deal with upward mobility, psychological support for poor communities so that they can move forward. So it's just not putting more money into somebody's pocket, but also looking at the overall well-being of the family. So target, in my view, 10,000 people in Selangor and 50,000 people all over the country. And you just have to follow the Sustainable Development Goals. Sustainable Development Goals has identified something like 17 different indicators which you have to achieve. One of them is no poverty, zero hunger, health and well-being, quality education, reduce inequality, economic growth, and decent work and economic growth, and so on and so forth. And Malaysia has subscribed to the SDG goals. Malaysian ministers and NGOs are all over the world talking about SDGs, how well it's being run. But the challenge now is to deliver. So that means in the next 5 years, we can say, yes, we have identified 10,000 in Selangor and 50,000 all over Malaysia. And in the 5 years forward, this is what we are going to be doing. And when the fifth year comes, to say, yes, we were successfully able to move 30,000 families, 40,000 families, or even 20,000 families out of poverty into, say, M4P or something like that. So this is a very targeted approach. I think this is where we are lacking. And this is the way, I think, to go forward. So education is, will focus a bit on education, on healthcare, the notion of, psychological support, and so on and so forth. Because today, if you look at especially Indian families, healthcare has become a number one issue. That the amount of money that people are paying towards diabetes and so on and so forth is extremely high. It's true even for the Malay community. But when you're already poor and you have a high dental health cost, that money is what you need maybe to put food on the table.
Right.
But now you have to use it for healthcare. So when you have a holistic approach to poverty eradication, that at least if you target 10,000 in the next 5 years, 5,000 is already delivered to M40, and then then maybe another 10,000 to 3,000 would be, you know, on the verge of moving. At least target it. So there is something to report. Now our reporting mechanism is a joke. Money is spent on poverty reduction, but where the money goes, nobody knows. But when you target 10,000, 5,000, then you have to give an account every year. Okay, from 10,000, this is what we have done. We have identified poverty. In this place, we have mapped the poverty. And for Indians, you actually can do it because Indians are not all over the country. It's spread in specified areas. So the fear is now that as poverty gets more entrenched, the challenge to get them out of poverty will become more difficult. So therefore, that is why I thought about, why don't we just focus, give the number, and get people to start planning, and the government to start planning to do that. And one of it, as I said, is education, healthcare, psychological support for the poor is actually very, very important. We only think, you know, only the rich need psychological support, but sometimes poor need the support more than others, because on a day-to-day basis, to get the money to pay for your rental itself can be a challenge.
Absolutely.
Can be a challenge.
Yeah.
And, you know, in our offices, we meet a lot of these people who come with all kinds of problems. And when we reach out, when we go to their homes, we see the problem so clear. So therefore, I think just focus on a number and see if we can deliver that number out of poverty. That may be a better approach. And we follow the SDG goals, where Malaysia actually has signed on to the SDG. And since you've signed on, we put the money and get the people to work on it. And I think we also have to move out of this notion that only the Malays are poor. The Chinese are poor. I mean, you must see, look at the Chinese poverty. It's serious on the ground. It's very serious. And the poverty and the health issues they have is equally problematic. So it's actually the Chinese, the Indians, the Orang Asli are even worse off. And you have, entire agency dedicated to support Orang Aslis. What can it say after all these years and all this money? How many people have come out of poverty in the Orang Asli community? Tragic what is happening. So therefore, I think we need to move to a different approach and to enable communities, especially poor communities, move out of poverty. We talk about a shared Malaysia. You know, the government has signed on to shared prosperity, but the prosperity cannot just be controlled and monopolized by the rich and the middle classes. It is the poor who need the prosperity. They need to move up. A country cannot be defined by 10 billionaires. It has to be, and it has to be defined by everybody enjoying the prosperity of that country.
Absolutely. And before we wrap this conversation up, YB, would you have some final message for us?
I think, you know, what Selangor government did is actually is quite good. For the first time, there would be a coordinating committee under the minister's office to coordinate poverty eradication efforts as well as entrepreneurship efforts, so that it's all consolidated and there is a plan going forward, and not everybody is doing their own stories and only their own thing. I think this is really good, and I would encourage other state governments also to look at both areas. One of poverty eradication, close the gap with the rich and the poor within the level of the state, and then also to look at entrepreneurship and get more people involved in entrepreneurial work. Do not have to turn them into a multi-million-dollar business, but at least slowly get the culture of entrepreneurship going so that even if the parents don't get it, the children will be able to take advantage of it.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Darshan. Really happy talking to you.
That was YB Charles Santiago. He's the Member of Parliament for Klang. If you missed any part of our conversation, we are also available on podcast. You can check us out on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcast from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.